poverty, chastity, and obedience address what's called the triple concupiscence by St. John in his first canonical epistle, chapter 2, verses 15 to 16. And I'm quoting from memory here, but I think I have it put down pretty well. So again, 1 John 2, 15 to 16. Brethren, he says, love not the world, for all that is in the world is the concupiscence of the flesh, the concupiscence of the eyes, and the pride of life, which is not of the Father, but is of the world. Okay, so the concupiscence of the flesh, the concupiscence of the eyes, and the pride of life. Some translations say the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. What is this? The concupiscence of the flesh? Well, that's the disordered passions for venereal pleasure, huh? The concupiscence of the eyes. This is the desire for things, right? For stuff, for money and all the stuff that money can get you. Gadgets, toys, those who assemble more and more stuff. Principally, the creature comforts of life, the kinds of things that make you a spoiled brat in the first world, huh? Where you have quote first world problems, right? We gripe when our internet connection goes down for a little bit, as opposed to people in the third world who might be inclined to gripe when they go yet another day without any food. So we tend to be a bit spoiled here. That's what we talk about with the pride of life, the concupiscence of the eyes. It's all the stuff, the creature comforts, the gadgets, the gizmos, the cars, the new iPhone, the latest iPad, the latest gizmo of whatever type. And then lastly, we have the pride of life. Well, what is that? Well, I mean, it's pretty much labeled there, right in it. It's the vice of pride, and which is a spiritual sin. In a sense, it's more subtle. But in a sense, it's worse because it's so much higher in the sense that it corrupts a higher faculty, right? The concupiscence of the eyes, pretty much, it has a matter of our passions. The concupiscence of the flesh, again, it's our passions and our body, right? The more gross parts of us. But the pride of life, well, that's in the will, and that's what's highest in man is his reasonable faculties, his intellect, and his will. That's what sets us off from the beasts, right? Bodily comforts and the desire to procreate and so forth are something that the beasts have. But pride of life, well, they can't have that. That's uniquely human. And that in that we resemble the demons, not the beasts, when we have that particular vice of pride. So I speak of the triple concupiscence here at some length, only to establish that this is the point of the councils. So poverty checks the pride of poverty checks the concupiscence of the eyes, right? This desire to accumulate stuff, the wealth of the world, right? Poverty radically checks that and removes that obstacle to the observance of the commandments and therefore to the practice of charity. Chastity radically checks the concupiscence of the flesh for evident reasons. Because when you say, I'm going to live a form of life in which there is no occasion for venereal pleasure, you remove it entirely, right? And therefore, it removes those series of obstacles to the observance of the commandments. And then lastly, we have obedience, which in humbling the will to the will of another, even a human, even a sinful human who's one thing for us to say, yeah, I'll obey God, right? Well, when's God going to come down and give you a command? He's not, right? It's up to the, if you're aware of what the commandments are, you have to obey that. All Christians have to obey. But when it's when we get a command from a man that we know isn't perfect, that requires real humility. We have to humble ourselves to the will of another. So radically checked here is the vice of pride, and therefore the pride of life that St. John speaks of as part of that triple concupiscence by the vow of obedience. So poverty, chastity, and obedience being added to the commandments remove the principal obstacles, again, St. Thomas says, to the observance of the commandments and therefore to the observance of the life of Christian charity. So, we speak of monks and nuns and friars and teaching brothers and nursing sisters and nuns and all that collectively, as I said, as religious. Why do we do that? Well, because these people are set apart to sort of specialize in the virtue of religion. Now, we're all bound to the virtue of religion. What is the virtue of religion? We tend to think of religion as synonymous with one's faith. You know, so-and-so is of the Catholic religion, so-and-so is of the Presbyterian religion, so-and-so is of the Muslim religion, or the Jewish religion, or the Buddhist religion, or whatever. That's not the way I'm using the word religion here. I'm using it quite specifically. Religo religare is the Latin word for to bind. And religion is a binding. What is it specifically? It's a binding to God, huh? So religious can be looked at as bound men and women in the sense that they have bound themselves by the vows, right? But in another sense, there is the virtue of religion. And what is that? I should say in another sense, but a related sense, there is the virtue of religion. What is that? The virtue of religion is part of the virtue of justice. Justice, a cardinal virtue and a moral virtue, is that virtue by which we render to the other what is his due. Okay, rendering to the other what is his due. That's justice. Quid pro quo, right? So, I want a banana. I go to the store. I look at the price tag on the banana. It costs X amount. I give X amount. I get banana. Okay, that is what's called commutative justice. I give the price for the thing, I get the thing. Huh? It's an exchange. That's a very simple form of justice, but rendering what is his due. So I take the banana in my hand, and therefore to the owner of that store, through his employee, the clerk, I have to render what is his due to get that thing, right? So this is the same with all sort of lawful contracts, right? Whether you're renting, you're buying something, rendering to the other what is his due. There are different forms of justice in civil society, distributive justice and commutative justice and legal justice, but we don't need to go into those distinctions. There's multiple forms of justice. But then there's the justice that's due to one's country. Okay, that's called patriotism. It's rendering to the fatherland, the patria, what is its due, and therefore to your fellow citizens or fellow subjects of the same monarch, if you're in a monarchy. But then when you talk about rendering the other what is his due when the other is God, then we're talking about the virtue of religion, huh? So what is the highest act of the virtue of religion? Well, it's sacrifice, right? It's sacrifice. So in the Catholic religion, in the Catholic faith, the highest exercise of our worship is, of course, the holy sacrifice of the Mass. And therefore, that is par excellence the act of religion, huh? The holy sacrifice of the Mass. But of course, attached to the Mass are all sorts of other prayers. So the liturgical prayers of the church are the Mass, the sacramental rites, and also the divine office, those eight offices that we've got throughout the day that monks always prayed. So there was Matins at midnight, and then they had later on Lauds and Prime and Terce and Sext and Vespers. And then Compline. I said eight. I meant seven. Sorry. So those seven offices are part of what we call the divine office, and it was truncated later into what's called the breviary. Breviar meaning shorter, right? So the divine office is part of the liturgical rites of the church, and it's part of the church's public worship. So the whole concept of a monk was somebody who was set aside for the divine worship. the Opus Dei, as it's called by Saint Benedict. Opus Dei was not a reference to some Spanish group of people in the 20th century who served God in the world in this sort of strange new form of life that we call secular institute. That's what Opus Dei is. That's a new thing in the life of the church. The Opus Dei is the monastic divine office. That's the Opus Dei. And that's why St. Benedict writes in his rule, let nothing be preferred to the Opus Dei, because that was the most important thing in their life, the singing of God's praises in the divine office. So, the religious is called religious because he's specially set aside to pay that debt on behalf of the rest of the church of rendering to God what is his due by way of praise, by way of prayer, huh? And not just official liturgical prayer, although, again, St. Benedict says, let nothing be preferred to it, but also private prayer, holy reading, Lectio Divina, as it would have been in St. Benedict's own time, what we now call mental prayer. All of this is a major part of the religious life. Without it, you're not a religious. Without prayer, the religious is just somebody wearing funny clothes, or I should say wearing unmodern clothing, right? That's all you are if you're not living a life of prayer. To paraphrase the Imitation of Christ by a man who was a religious, Thomas A'Kempis, he was an Augustinian canon.